So I've got McCann here from Eating Disorders Association NI. So, Anne, if you'd like to give us a little bit of background on who you are and what Eating Disorders Association NI is, just a little bit about who you are, what you do.
Okay, my name is Anne McCann, and I'm the founder member of Eating Disorders Association, and we're based in Belfast, a lower regional service. I started this support self-help organization in 1992, so almost 30 years ago, after my daughter had started to recover from serious anorexia. We provide a regional service, a 24-hour helpline, online support groups, a drop-in centre, and we do a lot of awareness raising programs in schools, community settings, and with nurses and teachers.
Right, fantastic. So you obviously have a lot of experience and kind of understanding of eating disorders and the treatments here. So I suppose for my first question, from your experience, what would you say about the treatment available to those with eating disorders in Northern Ireland? Is it adequate or is it poor? Are there high relapse rates, long waiting lists, a very specific focus on BMI in terms of who receives treatment and who's put on a waiting list?
Well, it's patchy, let's say it's patchy, but generally speaking, it's under-resourced. So, really, they could probably triple the number of staff that they have in each of the trusts, and there probably still would be waiting lists. The waiting lists are getting longer. They are when the new eating disorder service, which started in about 2002. With four teams across the whole of Northern Ireland. It was anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating disorder were the conditions that they would attend to, but very quickly they dropped the binge eating disorder. So we have a situation in Northern Ireland with people, and generally speaking, with bulimia, have the same problem that they find it very difficult to get any kind of professional help for their illness.
And so obviously that's really awful for those people who are suffering from that. And so then in terms of the treatment, if you do access professional treatment, would you say it's too focused on the physical symptoms of eating disorders, such as like either underweight or overweight BMI, lack of menstruation in women, deficiencies, rather than addressing the psychological issues which cause these the physical symptoms to occur? Because obviously an eating disorder is a mental illness, it's not a physical illness. So would you say that the treatment is too focused on these kind of things?
Well, I think it's too focused when they're diagnosing it. You know, they do tend to decide on the BMI. Quite often they don't admit that. You know, they say no, it's to do with psychological side of the illness as well. But generally speaking, there is a big emphasis before they can get in to get treatment with their BMI. But I think to be fair to them, you know, my reports back over the many years is that there have been improvements in the psychological help that they give. The problem is that so few people are able to access that professional help. So you don't hear an awful lot back from the people who do receive you know, good psychological treatment in the eating disorder service.
That leads really well into my next kind of question, which is, are those with eating disorders other than anorexia nervosa at a disadvantage in terms of receiving a diagnosis or treatment? So more specifically, are those with bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, or other specified feeding and eating disorder receiving maybe worse treatment, or rather like they're not getting treatment at all than those with anorexia? Is this maybe due to an existing belief that these disorders are less serious? Or what would you say is kind of
Yeah,
causing this?
well, I think there's maybe two things. I think there with a serious anorexic patient, there is always the fear of the deterioration in their physical state, and that kind of can sometimes cause a bit of a panic and they get into the service. I do think that whether they take it seriously or not, I'm not sure about that, but they just don't have the capacity to see many more patients other than those suffering from anorexia, because there's long waiting times even for the ones with anorexia. So the ones who have bulimia and binge eating disorder in particular just feel abandoned, and some of them will actually say that I was just left high and dry. And the system that they were trying in Northern Ireland, when it started, I was actually fortunate enough to be in place before we actually had a service in Northern Ireland. So I was allowed to sit in the negotiations when they opened when they started the service. And it was set up in a way that each trust would be given a small number of staff to start up with. And then that each year there would be an enhancement in the staff, and it would be a bespoke enhancement. In other words, each trust would then be asked, or each eating disorder team would be asked, well, what were the requirements? And that seemed to work for about 3 or 4 years and was working very well, and a good service was developing. But then the kind of crash came in the economy, and so everything stopped. There was no more enhancements. And I think there's just been a continual deterioration since that. Money is kind of piecemeal, and it's been put into different parts of the eating disorder service, but it hasn't been enough. And there's, I suppose a big turnover in staff because of this under-resourced situation. The staff are under a lot of pressure, and they do their best. The ones that I would know and hear from families, they do try their best, but they're under a lot of pressure.
It's just this, there's just so much. There's so many people who need treatment, but obviously there's just not enough funding to adequately kind of provide the treatment that's needed. So that's an issue with a lot of mental health sectors. I certainly know it's not just eating disorders, but it certainly comes up again and again.
Yeah, and I think it was very demoralizing for the people who were quite excited about the new service, myself being one of them, that it kind of stopped after a few years, the development of it and the enhancement stopped. So you kind of had a service that was cut off, at the knees, and has been floundering ever since. Now they have come up with several things, and there's been so many reviews, and the RQIA have investigated, and there's a whole lot of great ideas down on paper, but it would be good to see something practical develop from those. So far that I haven't seen that.
And obviously the pandemic definitely didn't help with anything like that. I'm guessing that set that back even more.
Well, probably, because every aspect of society here, no matter what you're trying to do, or even make phone calls or get some information, COVID seems to be used for everything now. That might be the case, that is what it is, but you're kind of getting a feeling now that if things aren't right, just blame COVID. So we'll see how that develops.
I suppose then another question I have is, so for people who do have eating disorders aside from anorexia, and even people who do have anorexia, would you say the treatment that's offered by the NHS is effective, or would you say it's perhaps maybe outdated, based on older psychological kind of ideas and evidence? Maybe does it not adequately address the kind of issues that cause people to act on eating disorder behaviors like binging, purging, restriction, compulsive exercise, and so on?
Well, I think to be fair to the service, any of the report backs that we get from people who've actually been successful in accessing that service, they They do report back that the treatment has helped them, and you know, many of them have, you know, been able to carry on with their lives. I think probably the big gap is in bulimia, and you know, anorexia. For every one patient we would see with anorexia attending the support groups are ringing us, you know, there would be five or six people with bulimia. So there's far greater number of people suffering from bulimia. And I think they're badly kind of let down. And it's very difficult whenever you're trying to kind of try to give them a bit of hope, because you can't say, well, look, there's this service, or you may have to wait, but you can get into this. At the moment, we provide support online, you know, via Zoom, for people with binge eating disorder. And we've just been able to kind of put it all together just before Christmas. And, you know, we've had a few, you know, people emailing us in to say, you know, how wonderful it was, you know, just to speak with people who were like-minded and were struggling in the same way as them. And it's really sad that they, and so there's an awful lot of depression then, you know, that sets in with you know, with most of those people that bring us up, they feel just, you know, totally forgotten about.
And then obviously that's not going to help them with coping with trying to recover by themselves if they don't have support. And then, you know, they're feeling abandoned by the service that's there supposedly to help them, but they can't access it. And it is a really difficult cycle. I mean, I do know that, you know, there is plenty of online like self-help and services, but for a lot of people, I'm speaking somewhat from my own experience and from people who I've spoken to, yes, there's that self-help online, but if you're feeling incredibly depressed, it can be so difficult to get started. And also you don't have the input of a professional explaining to you, maybe
it's hard to motivate yourself,
you know. Very difficult, and so I do, my greatest sympathies always go towards people who are in that situation, no matter whether it's an eating disorder or another mental health condition, because it's not an easy thing to deal with by yourself at the best of times. But you know, if you're in the full throes of it but you do want to recover, it is very demoralizing to have that happen, and it is a very sad situation. And that's why I felt the need to, you know, investigate it and talk about it, because I feel like sometimes people don't want to talk about it. I do sometimes think that eating disorders still have a lot of stigma around them, especially when you're thinking about maybe men who have eating disorders. So anyway, going on from that, obviously you see firsthand, and you've been in the services and you've seen the kind of system they had before. If funding wasn't such an issue, what changes do you believe that the healthcare system, not even just treatment centers specifically for eating disorders, but like wider, like GPs and maybe education in schools, like what more do you think could be done to improve the treatment that is available?
Yeah, first of all, I mean, anything you read about eating disorders, is, you know, is that the secret of success is to kind of nip it in the bud, that it doesn't get a grip on people, and particularly when they're very young. So I think that GPs, I think there needs to be someone, that doesn't have to be a doctor, you know, like a psychiatric nurse or whatever. So when a parent brings a young person, or a young person is old enough to go themselves to the doctors, that there would be somebody in the surgery, you know, can talk to them about their eating disorder, and be there to support them from a very, you know, from the very first time that they approach the surgery. One of the things that it seems so simple, but it doesn't seem to have been established here, is I think, you know, supervised eating is a big part in recovery. So, like, for example, I had a doctor on from the hospital in Belfast today. They have a young girl and who's 15. And she was very seriously medically unwell, with a very low BMI, and they have got her physically stabilized, And they're nervous about you know, discharging her because they find there's no one, you know, to help her when she gets out. So what should be there is that because she's been in hospital and, you know, resources thankfully have been successfully got her back on her feet physically, that there should be somewhere where she can go if it's needed to have supervised eating, so she can have her lunch and her maybe tea there, and, you know, able to kind of carry on with her life in many ways. And there's a lot of things, improvements could be there that wouldn't cost an awful lot of money. Mm. But they just need more people to pay attention and see the warning signs of an eating disorder in those early days and act, you know, as quickly as they can. Whereas we have, like this patient today, they're trying to get CAMHS to kind of take her under their wings now and look after her. And they were having difficulties.
God, that's because it's so important. Like, it's with people who do end up in inpatient, it's all very well, you get them into inpatient, they're under very good supervision. But when they are discharged, like, you have to be so careful that a relapse doesn't happen. They still need that support.
Absolutely.
And like, that is so important that is in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is, and there is an acknowledgement that is the case, you know, that the steering group, you know, that look at the eating disorder service in Northern Ireland, they do discuss that at their meetings, and, you know, they've said that it should be a priority if someone has had inpatient care, that when they come out, that, you know, that if they have a relapse, that they should be seen, you know, immediately. Because so much has been put into, you know, getting them well again, then, you know, when they've been younger, and resources put in from the health service, that they shouldn't be allowed to slip back in. Because quite often, if they do slip in, they're so disappointed in themselves, you know, they've had themselves back on their feet again and allowed themselves to slip in. So there's an awful lot of guilt involved, you know, when they do have a relapse. Even though I think they're warned that can happen.
Yeah.
So we just need more people trained, and that isn't going to happen tomorrow. You know, even if they poured a big sum of money into eating disorders, it's still going to take a time, because by the time people, you know, are attending hospital, they're very ill with an eating disorder, so they need somebody who is, you know, well qualified and, you know, with a lot of experience, where these young women or young men as well, there seems to be a big increase in them, you know, will connect with the person that they're trying to get treatment with.
I suppose that's another thing that I was going to say, because I do remember you mentioned before that sometimes what happens when you have someone who's been referred who has comorbidities, which are obviously quite common with eating disorders, like quite often the person will have depression, anxiety, they might have substance abuse issues. Like, I do remember you mentioning that often those get looked at first, and then the eating disorder is kind of ignored a little bit, and obviously that's very dangerous to do, because you might be treating another problem this person has, but at the end of the day you're not treating probably one of the more physically damaging parts, whether it be anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder, and so on. And do you feel like that really needs some attention about how they approach which area they tackle first if someone's displaying symptoms of an eating disorder and another mental illness?
Well, I do know now that some of the centres in England, they do a more holistic approach, you know, to the eating disorders. But you see, I think everything that's going wrong with the service here, anyway, it's due to the lack of resources. But if, for example, someone goes over to the centre in Belfast here, and they have, you know, serious eating disorder, but they also are self-harming, or they're also suffering from anxiety, but particularly self-harming, the eating disorder service wouldn't even see them. You know, there wouldn't even be a discussion there with them. they would be told at the assessment stage that they need to attend to their other issues first. And you see, I don't see, in my experience, is that they can be treated separately. I think they're part of the kind of main problem that the patient is feeling. And I think when that happens, all that happens is that the eating disorder gets more and more embedded. And it's harder in the end then to treat, even if the patient stays in. You quite often will find that the patient then will just, you know, not go for treatment. And then you're hearing something from, like I would hear from parents who say, oh, she was looked at by CAMHS, you know, when she was at school, but, you know, this didn't happen and that didn't happen, and so she just didn't go back. So it's a real crying shame that there's an opportunity for, you know, someone to, you know, have a good program of treatment, and that they can kind of leave their eating disorder behind them. But so many of the families that have phoned, you know, there's been an eating disorder when they were in their teens, and maybe they're, you know, talking about someone in their late 20s and it's back again.
It is so tricky. Like I know from people I know from me, it's not the problem with eating disorders and really any mental health condition is they're just not easily solvable, and it is very easy for you to slide back without the person realizing. It's not always a conscious turning back to their problems. It can be a very tiny thing, like Christmas, you know, obviously there's loads of emphasis on food, and then you get January where everyone, the whole society is talking about losing weight, and it can just maybe start out with the smallest thing, and then a couple of months down the line that person is into a full-blown relapse. And then if they can't get back to treatment, or if it was never fully addressed, like I think maybe sometimes what happens is it's maybe touched on but never quite fully addressed, and like it's, like you said, you have to nip it in the bud, you have to really get to the bottom of it, otherwise that person unfortunately will always have it at the back of their mind. I mean, there's a lot of debates in the kind of recovery community about whether can you be 100% recovered, or are you always living as someone who has had an eating disorder and will still have to deal with those thoughts. And I know those are two different arguments, and I've heard different arguments from both sides, but I side with the idea that you have to learn how to deal with those thoughts, those behaviours, the urge to do anything.
You have to manage them.
And I think unless you were taught that in treatment early on, or you're at least given enough treatment that you start to grasp those new coping mechanisms, those that ability to see the thought and separate from it, and maybe say, "No, that's my eating disorder. That's telling me that, and I that's not what I want to do." I think that is such a key part, and that's what is really sad about the services. Either you're not getting to them, or you get there, it's not fully addressed, and you've got someone who's unfortunately losing however many years of their life to it, or maybe even will sadly lose their life. That is the biggest thing that is really, really quite shocking about it. And it's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about trying to raise awareness about this, is because that is, if you really think about it, I don't think anyone deserves to have to suffer with that for so many years, when really it is curable. It's not incurable, it is curable.
And you can, and people learn to manage it, even those, even like my daughter didn't have any service. I mean, this is why, when you know, when people sometimes are kind of criticizing the service that we have, and I have to, and they'll say, "Oh, there's nothing there," and I have to say to them, "Look, I know what it's like when there wasn't a service. I mean, when my daughter was ill, it was before we actually had an eating disorder service here in Northern Ireland, and that was the scariest place of all, because you know, you had to kind of convince the doctor. I had to, rather, with her and with him, that her slow pulse rate wasn't to do with the fact that she was running all these miles every week as well. It was because she wasn't eating. And it was in a way, now for some parents I think it might even be worse, in that you know there's a service there. It's a very, I suppose, small, exclusive a group of patients that can access that service. So these parents are knowing that there's a service, specialised service here, but they can't access it. I think that might even be worse than the situation I was in, where there was no service. We just had to make the best of it and get whatever information we could. You know, we have the internet now, which helps. But in those days, I just had to get friends in America that sent me a lot of material about it to read about it. So unfortunately, you know, the service is up and running now 20 odd years. And yes, there have been improvements from not having a service, but there's so much more that could have happened, I think, in those years that hasn't because of lack of resources.
And that is really quite, you've really hit the nail on the head there, that idea that you know there's a service there, but you can't get to it, or you're waiting and waiting and waiting. Like that is, like, obviously your situation with your daughter must have been really awful and really terrifying, but there's also that idea of, you know, it's there, and maybe parents who have children who are currently having, you know, experiencing eating disorder, even people with an adult son or daughter who they're seeing their child essentially, you know, dying or causing a lot of harm to themselves, and they know there's something there that can help
them. It's very scary, very, very scary. I mean, last week I had this lady that phoned me a few months ago, and it turns out that she's a doctor herself, and I couldn't pick up her accent, but she had, I think, might have been Lithuanian type accent. And she phoned again last week, and her wee 13-year-old daughter had just stopped eating, absolutely stopped eating since Christmas. And this poor woman was in tears. And I'm thinking, she's a doctor herself. Like, what is it like for, and so there's certain things she could be checking out herself, you know, the fact that she, you know, her heart wasn't going into distress, or that there was other things, you know, physical things that were happening. Mm-hmm. What's it like with parents that wouldn't have that knowledge, you know? And yet this poor woman was totally and utterly panicking because she thought her wee girl, you know, was going to die, mm-hmm. and that she couldn't get help for. So, you know, so for some individuals, it's really a horror story whenever they have a daughter or a son that suddenly decides that I'm just not eating at all. Mm. So this woman was in their fourth day with her child, watching her not eat anything.
It's just so difficult because obviously, as a parent, you're going to feel really powerless because you want to help them, and you may be, and that's why I think there needs to be on top of like services needing more resources and things, I think more education about the warning signs and not just the obvious ones. Like, I'm a big advocate for, don't just look for weight gain, weight loss. Obviously there's lots of other things you can look at, like behaviors, just the little starting points that if you're someone who's had an eating disorder or you're experienced in that field, you know what that looks like.
You can pick it up, yeah.
Exactly, but you know, the average person won't know. I mean, I do remember my mum, luckily, read somewhere about the discoloration of knuckles and fingernails. Mm-hmm. And that was actually the one thing she spotted rather than anything else. Yeah, and I just think that maybe needs to be in schools, community centres, you know, parents' evenings or something. They really need to, and like all mental health conditions, whether that be self-harm, whatever, I really think there needs to be, in order for people to hit it early enough that they have a chance, they need to know what to look for, not just the obvious. Because by the time you see the obvious...
Those early signs, And I mean, you know, becoming obsessional with food. I mean, my daughter all of a sudden started baking and, you know, running from one TV and another of these cookery programs and things, but she wasn't eating herself.
Yeah.
You know, she wouldn't even like the spoon of the cakes that she was making. So there's a whole lot of things, but we would do a lot of awareness workshops now before COVID, although my colleague does a lot on Zoom now. But we have decided that we do schools, but it would be the secondary and grammar school age, you know, say from 12 onwards. And we've decided now that, and we've approached some of the primary schools, and they have said, yes, they would want to do these training, but a lot of training with the teachers into the P7, which would be 10 and 11 year olds, because some of the secondary schools we're going to were being told that these children are starting the secondary and grammar schools and already have an eating disorder. So we were thinking that the last year at primary school would be a good time to start doing, you know, workshops, but mostly not so much about what happens, you know, physically and mentally with an eating disorder, but more about self-esteem and you know, having a good kind of body image, attitude to themselves. So we have, with the help of Bodywise in Dublin, got a very good program now for younger children, which will be starting as soon as we're able to.
And I think that's really important, especially with social media. Obviously, you must know about how it is just a kind of a tinderbox for starting those issues with body image, with obsessions about certain diets. I mean, you can't look anywhere now without seeing about keto, intermittent fasting, and everything. And you know, it goes beyond a Photoshop model in a magazine. It's now people who are fairly quite normal, like normal people maybe at your school or something, they are photoshopping their pictures or doing things like that. And you know, it's, and like the other thing is, obviously with most eating disorders, they do seem to start around the beginning of puberty, because that's when you start to be a bit more aware of
your body.
And I do think a lot more needs to be done. I mean, a few things have been done in terms of social media. I know Instagram had a big kind of cleanse of like pro Anna, pro Mia accounts, which were promoting.
And you don't hear about them so much now, so you don't?
No, they used to be a big thing, certainly when I was a bit younger. It was a very big thing on Tumblr.
Some years ago was right. Exactly,
it was huge, but I don't see it, like, well, I say that, but you do see it on Twitter now. It's quite a big one. Right. And even YouTube, TikTok as well. But the thing is,
I don't see any of that.
I can tell you that it is there.
Yeah, I think that was partly to blame for, you know, at the beginning when there was a, you know, severe lockdown in the early stages of COVID. A lot of the families would say, oh, it all started out, you know, with good intentions, because she was a wee bit chubby, and there were all these things on the TV, social media. You go on TV and somebody's doing these special exercises in the morning, and then you look at another one and there's, you know, these vegan diets. And so a lot of young people, we got a big increase in the number of calls regarding, you know, very young children, like 9 and 10 year olds, and also younger males, you know, suddenly ringing their parents, you know, discussing with their parents that they had an event and they had a teen. I think that's one of the good things that's actually happened since I started this area of mental health many years ago, is that males now, I think, are starting to feel a bit more comfortable in acknowledging that they have an eating disorder. And like in the beginning, for the first few years when we had our support groups, it would have been very rare that a father would have come along, or a partner or a friend. Whereas as years have gone on, there's been a couple of our supports where our monthly meetings were, you know, it was almost all male. So I think, you know, males now are, you know, feeling a bit more comfortable in admitting that they have an eating disorder.
Yeah, and I do think that is one good thing you can credit with some ideas of social media, and certainly many campaigns that have gone on with the kind of acknowledgement, like, you can talk about these things. And I do think it's a really big thing with men to be able to talk now about self-esteem, eating disorders, even just like depression and things like that, especially because Northern Ireland has a quite a big problem with male suicide. I do think it is really good, and like you said, you actually see more men coming forward. I do think that is an improvement, but obviously, like we've discussed, there's a lot more that could be done in terms of services and so on. But I mean, it is really tricky because it is an aspect of we need more resources.
I mean, for us, it's a worry, Evelyn, because we get our funding every year. Now we get a grant from the Department of Health, very small grant, and then we get a top up with the board, the health board here. But each year, we have a worry, will it be renewed? So we only get yearly kind of contracts. We're actually going to recruit very soon now for one of our posts, but we can only have offer a contract for, say, a year that we know we have the money, and that kind of helps. It makes it very difficult for us to make long-term plans, to expand. So money for the, and in fact, I think we're the only eating disorder support group that gets any money, from the, no, there's another one down in Newry, but funding for us too is always very precarious, and we have to wait, we'll know in March whether we're going to get the money for the following year. So, it's not just the service itself, it's and we actually got a warning letter last month to say that because of COVID, that they're going to have to cut back on money for the health service. And the time when they're talking about all these great plans I have for mental health and eating disorders in Northern Ireland, now we've been kind of told that it's one of the areas that could be hit because of the COVID expenses. We'll have to watch this space and see what happens.
I know, and I really do hope that you can still keep going on because obviously you provide so much for people in Northern Ireland, and you obviously help so many people like you've discussed throughout this interview. But I do want to thank you for agreeing to do an interview. You've been really, really
Yeah.
great, giving me so
Yeah,
much
well,
insight, and it is fantastic to hear from someone who's been there like from the very beginning.
yeah, for a long time.